This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In September, Burlington Police Department officers shot a man who'd been characterized as threatening to harm himself and others. He was wounded but survived. The officers involved had turned off their body cameras because they said they were worried about blinking lights and sounds. Also that month, two officers responding to an emergency totaled their cruisers when they collided, and the department announced that it would no longer have any equipment from the U.S. military. In October, police investigated an alleged rape at the city's busiest courthouse, but declined to publicize the incident until the Burlington Free Press went forward with a story. The BPD defended its secrecy, saying they didn't want the suspect to know they were after him. He was later found and arrested in New York City. Also in October, the department investigated the distribution of Ku Klux Klan flyers to two black residents. And in December, two fatal shootings rocked the city. One involved a DEA raid that two Burlington officers were involved in, where a suspected drug dealer was shot and killed in his home. The other was a murder on Church Street a couple of weekends ago, just as bars and clubs were closing for the night. All of this has happened in the brief tenure of new chief Brandon Del Pozo. Del Pozo took over on September 1st, and at least by Burlington standards, it's been a remarkably busy 4.5 months for high-profile police activity. In July, before he was confirmed by the city council, Brandon Del Pozo told VPR how he planned to adapt the policing style of the NYPD, where he was coming from, to Burlington.
Understanding the shortcomings that have face the police department, and then bringing the best of it over to Vermont and scaling it down, I think seems like a challenge that I've been chomping at the bit for. And, I'm bringing a wife and two kids. We're going to try to buy a house, and we're going to try to make a life there. I'm excited about coming to Burlington.
Our guest today is Burlington Police Chief Brandon Del Pozo. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Jane. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Still as excited as you sounded in July?
Yeah, just doing that recap of the events of the last 4 months made my pulse quicken a little bit. I'll probably take a trip to the doctor just to get my blood pressure checked. But no, we're still very excited to be here. We did, in fact, buy a house in the city. My children are enrolled in two schools here in Burlington. And, the policing's been very challenging, and it's been great. It's good police work and in a great city.
You know, one of the speculations, at least among reporters here, has been, man, if that guy thought he was going to get an easy ride, it certainly doesn't seem to have been one. But did you think that this was going to be a little bit of light duty?
No, I mean, I'm in my early 40s. I didn't come here to retire. I came here to just do a different type of policing. I know this is a city that, as Mayor Murrow Weinberger says, punches above its weight in terms of population. It's one of these cities that captures people's imagination. And then the residents care deeply about everything. I laugh sometimes to a fault. But it's been busier than I thought it would be. But it hasn't, but it's been engaging. So, yes, I've enjoyed it, actually.
Busier than you perhaps thought it would be, and more high profile, as I said, than many people are accustomed to in terms of crime. A couple of officer-involved shootings, a murder on Church Street. This is not typical fare for Burlington.
No, I mean, if you look at the numbers, if you look at officer-involved shootings, you know, there was one in 1997, another one in 2013, and now between the DEA and my officers, there have been two this fall. And homicides as well, two in 2015. That's an increase of infinity percent over most years, and definitely more than we're accustomed to.
So is this something, though, that you feel like your experience at the NYPD prepares you for, even if it's not something that most Vermonters and most Burlington residents are necessarily prepared for?
Yeah, I have to say that, one of the things that I thought I would enjoy about this job is the ability to be a police leader who works directly with the government and with the press and with citizens. That was something, even as a mid to high level executive in the NYPD, I wasn't doing the political side of it and the government relations. But the police work, I have to say, for better or for worse, is police work that I've done before, whether it's managing huge crowds or investigating homicides or allegations of misconduct. The NYPD is the biggest municipal agency in the country. I think it's tied, or maybe New Delhi is bigger, but other than that, it's the biggest and certainly one of the busiest. So I want to knock on wood. I've seen most of this stuff before. It's just doing it in a way that suits Vermont. That's the challenge. Yeah.
We're talking again with Burlington Police Chief Brandon Del Pozo. And listeners, I'd love to invite you into the conversation. We ticked off a bunch of things that have happened in the city in the last 4 months. We could include in that number the recent headache caused by over-ticketing when Donald Trump came to speak last week and the crowd control that the Burlington Police Department needed to do there. If you have a question for Chief Del Pozo about all of that or other things that you're seeing in Burlington, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's get right into a couple of the serious things that have happened and things that are concerning to people and seem related: drug crimes, drug addiction, and homicides. Two events in December highlight the violence and seriousness of drug addiction and drug crimes in the state. The first we've mentioned briefly, but this was a raid by several agencies. It ended with a fatal shooting of a suspected dealer at a home in the Old North End. And separately, a few days later, another suspected drug dealer was shot and killed on Lower Church Street, just as bars were closing and there were people on the street. It was late at night. So first of all, what do you say to residents who see these two incidents happen within a couple days of each other? They're both related to drug crimes, allegedly, and who are thinking, oh, my gosh, what is happening in Burlington?
I mean, there's two things. Number one, Burlington remains an extremely safe city. And one of the things that we're going to do, and we've done it already, is publicize our crime data. We had an interactive map of robberies. We had an interactive map of car break-ins. You can go online and look at every reported crime in Burlington since 2013, except certain sex crimes. Right online, manipulate them. We're also releasing the 2015 year in crime very shortly. So you can look at it yourself. The crime here is not extraordinary. I mean, it is safe, but on the other hand,
it may feel extraordinary to people, though. I mean, it's one thing to say it's not extraordinary, and you know, you can cite all the statistics low crime rates. But for people who may have been in close proximity to these or who live in the city, this may feel very scary, even if it's a blip.
No, so what I will say is that left unchecked, our struggle with opiate addiction and with heroin in particular will change the face of the city. What we're seeing is the progression in violence that comes when, you know, when a bag of heroin sells for $10 in New York City, or maybe a little more than $10 in Boston, but sells for $20 to $25 here. You know, we're not talking about the addicts who need help or people who are struggling with opiate addiction and maybe selling on the side to finance their use. When criminal profiteers come to town, you know, violence follows. And to be candid, that's what we're seeing a bit more of.
It sounds like the raid that was led by the DEA on that suspected drug dealer, he was a white Vermont longtime resident, though, not
correct,
somebody who came from a city to sell drugs in the state.
No, that's right. And one of the things that we have to be extremely careful about is pointing at one particular person or one particular race of people and saying they're the problem here. That's just, it's lazy and it's counterproductive and it's just not true. You know, what we're seeing, though, is I mean, lots of different folks sell drugs and profit from the trade. You know, there's remarkable diversity in that regard. However, the drugs are brought from the East Coast cities, particularly from New York City. And when we look at where they're coming from, it's criminal gangs that are bringing them up here, many of which are led by African-American males. The drug problem itself up here, to be completely clear, multiracial, very diverse.
So what are you thinking needs to be done about that? You just said it is changing the face of crime in Burlington, and as we've been hearing for a couple of years now, certainly changing the face of communities in Vermont of people who are addicted to these drugs. So from your perspective, as chief of police in the biggest city in Vermont, what do you do to attack that?
Yeah, well, at tonight's city council meeting, the mayor's asked me to give a presentation, at least from the police perspective, on the state of opiate addiction in Burlington. One of the things I have to say, and it's the only way out, is to see this as a public health problem with a law enforcement component rather than a law enforcement problem with a public health component. People are using heroin. They're being persuaded to use heroin for a reason. And it's not just because people suddenly appear on the street selling it. They're responding to a demand. I think between initial problem was the overprescription of medical opiates, But now it's become fewer people are starting out as pill addicts. More of them are going straight to heroin, either snorted or injected. But it really is about increasing the amount of treatment that's available. We have a 250 to 300 person waiting list, depending on the day, here in the county alone with the Howard Center. It's about prevention, and it's about once people are off drugs, you know, giving them lots of reasons not to use them. Healthy, thriving, vibrant economies are more resilient when it comes to drugs.
You told VPR this summer that from the policing standpoint, cops should know who the addicts are because you can get good information out of them. Have you been successful in doing that since you arrived?
Yeah, and it's not just good, you know, good information, like you're treating them as a means to an end. I mean, so number one, there is, you know, an important way to combat drugs and find out who's selling them is to go to the source of people who are using them. But, you know, the bigger worry, we'll take the information. But, you know, people struggling with addiction are desperate. And it's just, you know, they're either acting out of desperation in our favor or in a drug dealer's favor. So, yes, I mean, what I found with the Burlington Police Department is they have a remarkably deep knowledge, my officers, of what's going on out on the streets of Burlington, who's new to the using scene, who's in the throes of it, who's in and out of jail. And some of the ways we've been able to, for example, locate the alleged courthouse rapist is by people who knew him, knowing where he was headed and where he was. That was very useful to us.
We're going to talk more about that case coming up. We're also going to be talking about the police reaction to the KKK flyers that were distributed to a couple of residents in the city. We're going to be talking about the use of body cameras. Right now, we're looking at drug crime, and we're looking specifically at two incidences that happened just a couple weeks ago at the end of the month. A raid on a resident's home in Burlington where he was fatally shot by the DEA agents. Burlington police officers were involved in that, and obviously it was in Burlington. We're also talking about the murder on Church Street. And if you have questions about that or other things that are going to come up in this conversation, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I want to ask you just a couple of specific questions about that raid.
Sure.
One of them was that this was a very densely populated neighborhood,
right,
and at least two of the bullets went through the home and left the targeted area that they were supposed to be in. And this seems like a pretty grave concern for the mayor. You've expressed concern about it. Do you think that raid was carried out appropriately?
Well, one of the things that we're waiting to do is see the conclusions of the Vermont State Police report, and we're also working closely with the DEA that's doing its own internal investigation. The idea that bullets would leave a residence, that they're fired in the first place, is a misfortune, but that they would leave the residence, go across an alleyway, and enter another residence is deeply concerning. One of the things I've made clear is I had an officer in that alleyway as well. So, you know, I can't hold this. No one can hold this in law enforcement at arm's distance. It was a federally signed by a federal judge, no-knock search warrant. They don't give out many of them. I think there was only three issued last year. You can correct me if I'm wrong. And the Burlington Police Department didn't do any no-knock warrants last year. So
this is when they don't have to knock ahead of time.
Right.
They can barge in. They have tools to break down a door, basically, so
yeah,
they're surprising a suspect so that no evidence can be hid or nobody can flee.
Yeah, just not only no evidence can be destroyed, but also if they believe the suspect has a weapon, it limits his ability or her ability to get that weapon ready. You know, you could always attempt to apprehend the suspect outside the home, but then you have, if they're very desperate, now you have a desperate person running around the streets. So I think it's a little early to comment on the propriety of the search warrant.
Should they have been carrying long guns, though?
Well, I mean, that's if you look, it's not uncommon for them to be carrying long guns, and that really. So there will be, at least for our part, for the Burlington Police Department, there will be a close tactical review. I mean, to be clear, we weren't the officers who fired. The officers from the Burlington Police Department weren't even in the apartment. But you're right. I mean, these are legitimate concerns. I'm not discounting them at all. They require a review.
And your officers had their body cameras on, it's come to light?
Yeah, so there was one officer who was issued a body camera, and he did have it on, and it did capture audio of the raid and some video footage of the exterior.
Will that be made public?
That will be up to a conferral with the Vermont State Police. That footage is evidence. It's in their possession, and we'll confer with them about that.
It was just announced that your department will, field officers will now be carrying naloxone, and this is the drug that helps reverse the effects of an opiate overdose. I was a little bit surprised to hear that it's just now that your officers are getting this, given that many departments in Vermont and even many volunteer EMT squads in the state have been carrying this drug now for about a year. What took so long?
Yeah, so that's a great question. You know, when I was back working in New York City, working for the chief of department there, Phil Banks, at the time, we were rolling out naloxone in New York City, looking at the acute overdose problem in the borough of Staten Island. So I came into this knowing that it was a great tool that could definitely save lives, and we wanted to put out there. One of the contrasts I'll draw between a lot of other areas in the state and Burlington is that there is no shortage of naloxone out on the streets of Burlington now, nor was there. The fire department had it for the longest time. The Howard Center was giving it out to all people who requested it. And if you look, there has been a paucity of overdose deaths because naloxone is getting used here. These other rescue squads you're talking about were working in areas where they didn't have that redundancy. They were probably going to be the first providers. Those other, for example, the state police working in rural areas. We're the third line of, we're probably going to be the third line of defense to get there. First, the users and their loved ones have naloxone, and then the fire department arrives, and then the police department. It wasn't this vacuum that we were filling.
Who's paying for the naloxone that your department will have?
That's a great question. It's not very expensive, and I don't know. We have it.
So it could be just in your budget. This is not
I don't have any objection. I mean, that's not. I'm sorry to be unprepared for that question, but we're going to have it no matter who's paying for it, us or someone else.
We're talking to Burlington Police Chief Brandon Del Pozo. We're talking about a lot of things that have come up since he took the helm in September, just 4.5 months in, and there's a lot to talk about. We're also going to be looking at his approach to policing in Burlington and other questions that you may have. Coming up, we'll also discuss those KKK flyers. We're going to talk about the issue with body cameras and more. Your questions are welcome, 1-800-639-2211, or post thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're talking with Burlington Police Chief Brandon Del Pozo about some of the noteworthy cases and events that the department has been involved in since he took over from former Chief Michael Sherling in September. If you want to ask a question about what's come out of the situation with the KKK flyers or Del Pozo's thoughts on drug dealing in the city and whether it's on the rise or just highlighted by two recent fatal shootings, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 or post your questions on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Chief Del Pozo, you mentioned briefly a couple minutes ago this courthouse rape incident, and this was an alleged rape that took place inside the busiest courthouse in the city. Your department didn't publicize that incident and, in fact, tried to keep it from the public and the press until it was uncovered by the Burlington Free Press, and you criticized that paper for revealing details, although it didn't identify the victim by name or identifying characteristics. And you said that you'd made the decision not to notify the public, in part because the suspect was not considered a danger to the wider public. But this was a suspect who had allegedly not only raped a woman inside of the courthouse bathroom, but had threatened two other women. I think they were staffers or people who were doing business at the courthouse, who it sounds like he did not know. And they said they were threatened enough that they felt like they had to hide. They were scared. That sounds fairly menacing to the general public.
Yeah, sure. And to be clear, I mean, we have an administration that's committed to transparency, and this is sort of the exception that proves the rule. And it wasn't something, you know, we didn't open up a playbook and go through a flowchart and go, don't say anything about this until he's arrested. It was a difficult decision. I mean, if you look at it, you know, the incident was reported to us on a Friday. The victim was interviewed through the weekend, Saturday, Sunday. We're hoping that the defendant would show up at a court appearance on Monday. When he didn't.
In Vermont.
When he didn't, we wrote an affidavit for his arrest on Tuesday. Free Press found it on Wednesday and reported it on Thursday. It wasn't like it was something that was being, you know, sat on for weeks and weeks.
Although, if I may push you on that, that idea of two women at the courthouse who said they did not know him and who were threatened by him, if this is somebody who's at large, whether he's going to appear at the courthouse on Monday or not, Is that not a threat to the public if you think he's still in Vermont?
No, if he showed up, he would have been summarily arrested. Number
one, but that's
one,
a few days after the election.
Yeah, and he wasn't targeting. There was obviously a certain amount of frustration that culminated with an alleged rape in a bathroom. Somebody that he knew quite well, the victim he ultimately chose, was well known to him, and we believe that he targeted her precisely because they had a long history together. And so we didn't think that that danger extended to the general public. We didn't think he'd come back and retarget folks at the women at the courthouse. And again, like our intention, and we didn't seek a sealed affidavit. And lots of folks at the courthouse knew about it. We just didn't want this gentleman to, run to the far corners of the earth, knowing that there was a big manhunt on for him. And we did actually have to go find him in an apartment complex in the Bronx. Ultimately,
do you know when he left Vermont?
Fairly soon afterwards, it turns out.
So he was probably gone by that weekend.
Right.
This was I think the incident had allegedly happened on Thursday.
Right. So it would have been and reported to us on Friday. Yeah, he left fairly soon. We had no way of knowing. I mean, it's imperfect knowledge, but we don't want to give him a reason to flee.
Would you make the same decision again?
I mean, that's a tough choice. My inclination is always not to. I mean, listen, the CUSI, the Chittenden Unit for Special Investigations, had a press release drafted. It would have been just a question of putting it out. I think now, going forward, we'd err towards notifying sooner.
Even if it meant that your suspect might be in the wind because he knew that you were after him.
No, I mean, let's just say this, asking if I'd make the same decision again. I think the public's going to see, instead of this hypothetical, if the exact same fact pattern obtained, what would I have done? You can expect to see, a real robust transparency from the Burlington Police Department, one that will affirm our commitment to sharing information with the public.
I want to bring up another question about transparency and play a cut of tape that I'm sure you're familiar with. And this is about body cameras and the use of body cameras. In September, Burlington police responded to an incident at a Colchester mobile home park that ended up with police shooting a man there. And in that incident, the officers turned off their body cameras. This was before the shooting. This was a man who was threatening harm to himself and others and seemed to be in an agitated state, according to what the police have said. So they turned off their cameras, they said, because they thought that blinking lights from the cameras and sounds that remind the officers that the body cameras are running would reveal their location to the suspect or put them in danger. In November, VPR uncovered and reported that the equipment could actually be put into stealth mode. And that information seemed to genuinely surprise Deputy Police Chief Bruce Bovat, who was in a phone interview with one of our reporters.
Holy mother of f***. Are you saying that all we have to do is hold the button for 10 seconds and it goes to stealth mode, but we can hold it again for 10 seconds and it'll come back?
So that was Deputy Chief Bovat, and he was actually speaking to another officer at the time. Our reporter was having a recorded conversation with him and could hear this. And so, it seems like some genuine surprise, but it also suggests that your officers did not know all of the ways that they could use these body cameras.
Yeah, sure. I think an important lesson from that exchange was to make it clear to Taylor Dobbs when you're speaking off the record. But apart from that, that level of confounding surprise on Chief Bovat's part makes it clear that this was something that the department was unaware of. In fact, when we called, they don't call it stealth mode in the manual. They just say to get the light to go off, hold this for 10 seconds. And when we called up Axon, Taser, the makers of the cameras, the field rep was surprised as well. He didn't know how to get the button off. So what we did, in fact, they just... we're here this week, but we brought in two consultants who've consulted on body camera use for the Department of Justice, Joe Freer and Ari Moss from Blue Tech Consulting. They're also to disclose fully the two men who are helping the NYPD do a 35,000 person body camera program. They came in and looked at all of our practices, our procedures, the practical ways in which we use the cameras just to make sure that they conform with best practices. It's an evolving technology. We're one of the leaders in that technology. Body cameras are a force for good. And obviously, it goes without saying that we didn't know how to use the cameras fully then, but we will. That was something we learned from.
And so that training that you just mentioned, is that what you were referring to in November when you said you were going to take steps on addressing training for body cameras?
Yeah, so we've not only trained up on ways to adjust the light and sound of the individual camera unit, but we've taken a larger look at just the whole way in which we deploy cameras, tag evidence, file the evidence, electronically store it, all of that. And there's a report coming back to us in the next week or two from Joe and Ari, our consultants. And again, these are gentlemen who've done this for the Department of Justice, so it should be an illuminating report.
Before we leave this topic, Chittenden County State's Attorney T.J. Donovan said he planned to investigate whether what your department had told state police about the body cameras as they investigated that shooting deserved a closer look. Do you expect to hear charges from him on that?
No. In fact, we've spoken with T.J. The first thing that he asked for was a thorough internal investigation by a third-party investigator. So we've contracted with a third-party investigator to look at that, the way our officers testified and gave information to the state's attorney and the state police. And that investigation should wrap up shortly. We should see some conclusions soon.
We have listeners on the line who want to talk to you. And if you're among them, you haven't called yet, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Jackson, calling in from Orange. Hi, Jackson. Go right ahead.
Yeah, okay. Hey, Chief. I'm originally from Bridgeport, Connecticut. My uncle was the chief of detectives there. So I'm up here 20 years. I'm in the upper Connecticut River Valley. I started going up to Burlington last year to see music. You know, I stayed at 3 in the morning. I walked the whole town, you know, from Radio Bean to Nectars. And I talked to all your officers that are out there, male and female both, and every one of them's real upbeat. And I saw two fights get de-escalated real quick by officers and calmed right down. So I just called to give you a thumbs up. You're doing a good job, and your cops are absolutely excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, and I'm glad you mentioned de-escalation. One of the things you see in American policing in general is that police have the prerogative to use force, but we're coming to reckon with the fact that that's not always the best thing to do, even if we have that prerogative. The Police Executive Research Forum, headed by Chuck Wexler, is engaging in this multi-agency. It's really the leaders of American policing from New York to Philly to Washington, this redesign of the curriculum for use of force nationwide to emphasize de-escalation. I mean, we're really proud. In fact, one of our lieutenants, Sean Burke, is headed to Washington tomorrow to participate with another 24 agencies on the design of that training. At the end of the month, on the 29th, if there's no crises, I'll be in Washington with Chuck and Perf to roll out this curriculum that emphasizes de-escalation in the use of force. So hopefully it'll be the beginning of a sea change in American policing. But thank you for bringing that up. I appreciate it.
You know, along what seemed to me sort of similar lines, you've recently appointed one of your officers to be specifically focused on domestic violence prevention. So not necessarily looking at incidents after they've occurred, but really addressing prevention. Was there a specific reason you wanted to highlight that and have a position for that?
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, domestic violence crimes statistically are down, but that doesn't mean that that's good. That just means that we're headed in the right direction and there's more work to do. What always troubled me about domestic violence is it doesn't get a lot of attention because it happens in households behind closed doors, and the victims have an inclination not to speak out because it's against, you know, alleged perpetrators that they have relationships with, that they care about. So I started that position. Crystal Wren, Officer Wren, she's corporal. She's fantastic. It's one of her passions. And it's really about where a city of the size that one officer dedicated to domestic violence prevention can really identify and manage and work with the at-risk victims and the at-risk households, regardless of the type of domestic relationship. They cover all the full spectrum. And so it's about getting inside that cycle of domestic violence. You know, this is a crime that happens cyclically. So the officer is going to get in there, let people know they have a voice, they have an advocate, they have resources, there's someone they can turn to. If people are being needlessly silent as victims, to encourage them to speak up and really let folks know that they have a place to turn to, there are ways out, and also, to be frank, that there'll be consequences if you commit domestic violence.
This is something that's touched your department as well, with two officers charged with domestic violence in the past year. Obviously, these weren't your hires.
Right.
Do you think there's a cultural problem in the department?
I think that officers work in a really high-stress job in general, and I think that culturally officers can become insular because nobody understands policing like other cops. I think that one of the ways that police officers everywhere fall short is that two cruiser accident that happened at 70 miles an hour was one officer racing to help other officers, literally risking her safety to get there.
This was a call that had come in, and then it had been escalated as something that people right. needed to respond to quickly.
Right, but I'm saying the only way officers in danger aren't in you know, high stress crime situations. They're in danger like anyone else, dealing with alcoholism, dealing with domestic violence, dealing with troublesome relationships, and officers really need to help each other. Sonny Privetto is our licensed social worker. We have a budget line for him. He works out of the police department. One of the things we lament is that officers don't refer their buddies to help sooner. I mean, it's funny. You look at our department, domestic violence and drunk driving are two things that touch everyone. The bar is extraordinarily high for police, and we need to live up to it.
Let's go to Creighton, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Creighton. Go ahead.
Hi. I actually live at 105 Elmwood, along with the two other roommates. It was the apartment that the bullets came into.
This is the DEA-led raid in December. Yeah, go ahead, Creighton.
And we're still actually kind of dealing with the stresses and stuff from that, and talking to a couple different attorneys. And moving forward, we were just wondering if it's protocol to not notify neighbors in proximity of such a high volume raid with such high powered weapons. I mean, there was no roadblock or anything. I was like pretty much a red light away from pulling down the driveway that the bullets crossed.
Yeah, listen, I'm relieved to hear that you're okay. I mean, one of the things that we say is this gentleman made no secret about selling drugs constantly from his home. I think that it was well known that he was an extraordinary danger to everyone around him. I heard that from city councilors and residents. So the danger, first of all, wasn't just brought there by the police. It was, this man, you know, he in fact had shot someone in the face prior to this. So there was always a danger on Elmwood Avenue. It was a great danger, and the police were trying to address it. One of the things to be clear about search warrants is if we start evacuating everybody around the home, there's going to come a time where a man who knows he's engaged in a crime is going to say, hey, they're asking everyone to leave but me. It's time to come up with a plan to destroy my evidence and get the heck out of here. So we really, really, I'm not discounting your concern. It's genuine, and it's something that the mayor and I are taking very seriously. We're not in the practice of pre-evacuating. If it becomes a barricaded situation, a hostage situation, an ongoing situation, we will evacuate. But warrants need an element of surprise. And it really comes down to a thorough, thorough review of tactics. The Burlington Police Department is committed to using the right tactics in its own warrants to get people under arrest safely.
And that, as we talked about earlier, may relate to what kinds of weapons are used in a situation
yeah,
like
correct.
That. So let's talk briefly about another incident that happened this fall. And this was at the end of October. Residents in Burlington were disturbed to learn that two women found white supremacist flyers at their homes. And there are a couple of layers to this story that were disturbing for people. First of all, just the actual facts of that case, that happened in Burlington, and that these two African-American women were apparently targeted by this. But also, some felt there was an inappropriate response by police dispatchers when, I think it was the father of one of the women, initially called to report this incident. And a Black Lives Matter rally was held in Burlington a few days later, at which you agreed that police dispatchers should act differently. What do police in Burlington need to do to earn the faith or keep the faith or maybe regain the faith of people in color in Burlington?
I mean, the first is to every single police encounter that we have with someone, whether it's friendly or slightly adversarial or with a motorist or otherwise, has to treat that person with dignity and respect. They have to feel first and foremost as a citizen that they've been treated fairly as an individual. It's hard for me to articulate what fairness means to a city or a community, but it is easier for me to articulate what fairness means to a person. I think they know it when they see it. And the same thing in return to our police officers. They're people and Vermonters. They need to be given the benefit of the doubt and treated well as people too. And then beyond that, I think one of the things that came out of that incident, for example, every dispatcher with a handful of just scheduling issues received a fair and impartial dispatching training.
Just recently.
Just 2 days ago. The dispatcher who made that call, we found that she said there's no one else you can talk to, and she hung up. And that's a procedural violation. We didn't substantiate bias on her part. We didn't think there was any, but because of the legacy we're dealing with, just that appearance is enough to concern people. and we had to address it. We're committed to. So lastly, I'll give you an insight into what we're doing. The Flynn is having a showing of Black Angels over Tuskegee, which is about the fight of Black Americans to put on a uniform and fly fighter planes for a country that wouldn't even let them use the same bathroom as white people, which I think is extraordinarily compelling. All of our new recruits, all of our recent graduates, our recruiting staff, our new members of the department will all be attending that showing. We're figuring out ways in a state that's not as diverse as its neighboring states to increase empathy, increase understanding, to know where other folks are coming from. That will hopefully yield respectful, above board encounters between citizens and the police. And those personal encounters are what foster legitimacy between a police department and its citizens.
Does the Burlington Police Department need to make changes in its recruiting process to attract candidates from those different backgrounds as well?
Only insofar as Vermont does. I mean, we aggressively recruit candidates of color. It's just hard to convince them to move up to northern Vermont at this point for a lot of reasons, culture, economy, maybe just lack of diversity in the city. So, I think we all have to move forward together on that.
Chief Del Pozo, I mentioned right at the beginning that you started in September. It's been a pretty busy several months for you. You said you have bought a house, your kids are enrolled in school. Have you been able to enjoy Vermont at all, or are you regretting this decision and looking back towards New York?
No, listen, I'm on the, I was on the summit of Camel's Hump 2 weekends ago with the head of search and rescue. And I found winter. It's up there above 4,000 feet. I'm loving it. The only thing I'll say in closing is that in my contract they promised me snow, and the state's falling a little behind on that. But once that comes, I think everything will be great. It'll be the best of all worlds.
The state's trying to give you an easy first winter. Brandon Del Pozo is chief of the Burlington Police Department. Thank you very much for talking with us
today.
Thank
you, Jane. It's great to be here.
Coming up, Susan Murray has been one of the forces behind legalizing same-sex marriage in Vermont for the past 20 years. Now the organization she founded with Beth Robinson, Vermont Freedom to Marry, is shutting down. We'll get her reflections next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. After 20 years, the group that helped legalize same-sex marriage in Vermont is ending its run. Vermont Freedom to Marry was founded in 1996 with the goal of ensuring equal marriage rights for gay and lesbian partners. It led the fight that resulted in civil unions in Vermont and pushed for marriage, which the legislature passed in 2009. But after last year's U.S. Supreme Court decision rendering marriage legal across the country, the organization says it's time to say goodbye. Susan Murray co-founded Vermont Freedom to Marry. She was lead counsel representing the plaintiffs in Baker versus the state of Vermont in 1999. That's the case that led to the first in the nation civil union legislation the following year. And she joins us now. Susan Murray, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So as I said, you co-founded Vermont Freedom to Marriage in 1996 with Beth Robinson. And at the time, the very name of the organization, which I just butchered, Vermont Freedom to Marry, was so aspirational. I mean, let's remember there were no civil union laws anywhere in the country, let alone marriage rights. Did you have a sense of if marriage equality was really possible and a timeline in your head for when you thought it would be achieved?
I did. At some point, also, the Vermont Freedom to Marry shortened its name. But when we first incorporated back in 1996, we were actually called the Vermont Freedom to Marry Task Force because we thought we were going to be a temporary organization organized for this one specific purpose of trying to work for marriage equality. So we never had any kind of a broader mandate than that. But I used to say back during the civil unions battle back in 2000, 50 years from now, everybody's going to look back and wonder what all the big hullabaloo was all about. And, you know, it took 15 years instead of 50, so I was off by 35 years in a good way from my perspective.
Well, given that you thought it was going to happen one way or another, why was it something that you wanted to put so much of your own blood, sweat, and tears into?
I'm a lesbian and thought that I wanted to marry my now spouse, but my partner of 30 years now. It seemed outrageous to me that I couldn't. But from a professional standpoint, I saw hundreds of gay and lesbian couples in my office as a lawyer who came to me and asked me to help them draft legal documents that would approximate marriage so that they could be legally protected. So I drafted wills and powers of attorney and things like that. But there were so many legal rights that were only granted by the state of Vermont or by the federal government, things like Social Security survivor benefits and tax benefits. And I couldn't, no matter how many documents I drafted, I couldn't fix that problem and that big hole. So that led to the obvious solution from my perspective, which was to fight for marriage equality.
So when the Vermont legislature then legalized civil unions in 2000, outside of perhaps, you know, your bubble, it was certainly hailed as a landmark case and this huge achievement, but it wasn't marriage. What did your head and what did your heart feel at that time?
Well, my head was exhausted. you know, we knew that this was just the first step, and I think we recognized that half a loaf was better than nothing, and that's why the Vermont Freedom to Marry Task Force compromised and agreed to work with the legislature to try to get the civil unions bill passed. But we all recognized that it was only a halfway measure and that we really needed to move forward with full equality. I mean, civil unions, as you put it, Jane, was not recognized anywhere in the rest of the country at that time. So when you traveled over to, say, you went to Dartmouth-Hitchcock to go to visit a doctor, suddenly you didn't have anything. You weren't related to one another anymore. You had a civil union in Vermont, but you crossed over the river and you were nothing. You were legal strangers. So we had to fix that. We knew that civil unions was not good enough.
Yeah, and not everybody was satisfied with that half loaf, even at the time, if I recall. You know, some people said this is a half measure and it's not only not good enough, but it's not what we were fighting for.
Absolutely. We spent, as you say, now Justice Robinson and I spent a lot of time talking with the other folks at Vermont Freedom to Marry Task Force, the activists and volunteers, when the legislature decided it was not going to draft a marriage bill in 2000. We spent a lot of time talking about whether we wanted to oppose the civil union bill at the time and go back to the Supreme Court and say, look, this is a half a loaf. It's not good enough. But we decided that it was better than nothing, and we knew that it was a big deal in 2000, a very big deal. As you say, not only were there no legal protections for gay couples anywhere in Vermont or in New England or in the United States, but nowhere in the world were there any such legal protections. So the civil unions bill and law was a watershed, but we also knew that it wasn't going to fix all of the dilemmas that I certainly saw in my legal practice. So we went back to the drawing board and worked harder for the next 9 years.
I'm talking with Susan Murray. She was co-founder of Vermont Freedom to Marry, which has just recently announced that it will disband. Susan, most people know about the two really huge events in Vermont, the passage of civil unions and that veto-busting passage of same-sex marriage in 2009. And I'll remind people this was the first time that any state legislature had passed marriage equality rather than a state court. Can you fill us in, though, on a little bit of what Vermont Freedom to Marry was doing behind the scenes in those 9 years in between?
Well, it was a little bit like, you know, on the outside, sort of knocking on the door and finding it locked. the legislature, the political class, I would put it, was exhausted and did not want to hear from us. Funders were you know, people who were willing to provide money weren't interested, and so it was difficult. So we went back to our grassroots and spent a lot of time traveling around the state, and certainly Beth did the lion's share of this, without a doubt. Went and spoke with very small groups of folks all around the state trying to talk about the issue, trying to explain to people why civil unions was only a half measure, and really working hard behind the scenes to try to wait for the political climate to change. And I think it did. I think the help Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court's decision in 2003 to allow marriage equality in the state of in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts really helped. Provide an impetus, because now Vermont, we weren't the only ones, and when people saw that the sky didn't fall crash in Massachusetts, it became a little more palatable politically to try it here.
You mentioned that the Vermont Freedom to Marry Task Force, as it was called then, was always created as a temporary organization. You never planned to have this be something that was around 100 years from now. But it did have to last 20 years. So does it feel bittersweet for it to end or good? What are you feeling?
You know, there's still a lot to do, right? There are still pockets in this country that are resisting marriage, you know, granting marriage licenses. Those things have to be addressed. There's still a need for educating folks, I think, around the country that, you know, allowing gay couples to marry is not going to undermine their own marriages. There's still there's still parts of this country where gay and lesbian couples can get married, but then they can get fired from their jobs on Monday. They don't have any other legal protections. So those things still need to change. But the organization, this particular organization, really has fulfilled its mandate. And I don't think I anticipated it lasting a full 20 years. But I'm happy that it's no longer needed in this state.
That's Susan Murray. She's a partner at the law firm Langrock, Sperry & Wool and co-founder of Vermont Freedom to Marry, which is disbanding after 20 years of work on legalizing same-sex marriage. Thanks for talking with us, Susan Murray.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that'll do it for today. The legislature is considering legalizing marijuana. But what would that actually look like if approved? In his last State of the State address, Governor Shumlin laid out specific guidelines that he'd like to see in a legalization bill. Tomorrow on this program, we'll look at those ideas and at what has or hasn't worked since legalization was approved in Washington and Colorado. You can email your thoughts on how to create a framework for legalization or why not to. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.